Our last case today is Knightley versus the State of Washington.
Your Honor, I'm so sorry. My name is Alec Abram Zimmerman, and you have today my case. So I'm a little bit surprised why you don't want doing this public hearing.
Your case is not set for oral argument. The calendar announcing that it was not going to receive oral argument was published some time ago. Neither of the attorneys, well, you're representing yourself, neither you nor the other attorney objected to that calendaring. This is an inappropriate time for you to come forward and interrupt our proceedings. Would you please be seated?
Yeah, but this case is very unique.
Would you please be seated?
No analogy in American history. Yeah, I know. Thank you very much.
Counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Counsel, is it Snively?
It is, Your Honor.
All right. Will the appellant counsel please come forward and we'll get started.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Mick Brainerewski with the Washington Appellate Project on behalf of Mr. Snively in this appeal from a 7109 unconditional discharge trial.
Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please. Your Honor, as was briefed, Mr. Snively is entitled to a determination as a matter of law that the evidence presented with respect to the risk criterion at his unconditional discharge was legally insufficient. And that is so even taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, even when we consider the fair-minded juror standard that applies. While Dr. Amy Phoenix did testify that in her opinion as a forensic psychologist, Mr. Snively met criteria, when the court considers the qualifications, the internal inconsistencies, and the concessions that accompanied her testimony, as well as the fact that DSH...
And all of these were pointed out to the jury, right? I mean, she was cross-examined quite vigorously, I thought, and at least some of these points were made, and the jury was well aware of them. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor, you are.
And the jury took that into account in sort of weighing her testimony and deciding what amount of credit they were going to give to it?
The jury certainly reached its verdict, and I presume they considered her testimony. One of the things that did transpire and is part of the record is that the state, in their closing argument, specifically told the jurors that they can disregard in full the expert testimony that was presented below. That I think was an irregularity that ought to be considered.
Was there an objection to that?
There was an objection, Your Honor. There was an objection to that.
There was, okay.
Yes. And the court's response was to give the standard, you are the ones to gauge the evidence, what the lawyers say is not argument, not the law.
You have not challenged the trial court's admission of Dr. Phoenix's testimony on appeal, have you?
No, Your Honor. That was not a challenge that was made on appeal.
I guess my point was that why would this not be an issue for the jury? They've got testimony coming from your expert witnesses. They've got Dr. Phoenix's testimony. They weigh it. They decide who they believe, and that's generally an issue that is not going to be addressed on appeal because it's the province of the jury to make that determination.
Well, it is, but it's still subject to appellate review. And if we consider the Brooks opinion and its discussion of Addington, we arrive at an understanding of what the state's burden of proof is in a 7109 proceeding. They must produce proof that the respondent's future risk exceeds the 50% threshold, but the quantity of proof that they are to provide, it is proof to a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And if the court considers...
Would you agree that if in fact, a jury were to give credit to all of Dr. Phoenix's testimony, that standard would have been met?
No. And therein lies the rub. The reason why I can answer that question in that fashion, Your Honor, it is because Dr. Phoenix's testimony with respect to the risk criterion contained a great deal of qualifications and internal inconsistencies that speak directly to the question of whether the statutory burden of proof to a beyond a reasonable doubt was satisfied or not. Dr. Phoenix may very well hold an opinion as a psychologist that Mr. Snively met criteria, but that on its own does not resolve the question of sufficiency of evidence. For example, in this case, where the actuarial instrument that Dr. Phoenix used indicated that Mr. Snively's 10-year expected recidivism risk was under 10%, Dr. Phoenix said, if I don't use the actuarial instruments and just flip a coin to see if a person is going to reoffend or not, about half the time I will be right, half the time I will be wrong.
Didn't she also testify that in her professional opinion it was more than 50% in this case?
She did, Your Honor. She undoubtedly did.
She also explained why using the actuarial tools could lead to the wrong answer in Mr. Snively's circumstances. Did she not?
She did.
Okay. If the jury believed all of that, why isn't that sufficient?
In this particular case, that was not the only expert testimony that was presented.
But then we get to the who did the jury believe. The jury could believe, wouldn't you agree, Dr. Phoenix and discount the other folks?
I don't think that's the right way of characterizing it.
The crux of this is whether there's sufficient evidence, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in making that determination, we have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state and all reasonable inferences. So we wouldn't necessarily look at anything other than Dr. Phoenix, would we?
I accept that construct. But as I said previously, the qualifications that Dr. Phoenix puts on her own testimony make it so that there is actually insufficient proof to the beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
Which qualifications of her opinion that Mr. Snively more likely than not will reoffend would you identify for us in the record?
Your Honor, beyond what I identified as her comment that if she doesn't use an actuarial instrument, the result is that there is no confidence in her opinion is critical. And in this particular case, while she does use the static 99R instrument in her risk assessment of Mr. Snively, she utterly disregards it, which is the same as not having used it at all. Beyond that...
But she explains why, though, doesn't she?
She does, but
is
that...
Is the jury allowed to agree that her reasons for disregarding the test are justified?
They may certainly do so, but that doesn't change her understanding of the effect on the level of certainty that she, even as a psychologist, can have in her opinion.
Are you telling us that she has to testify that she is of the opinion beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Snively more likely than not will reoffend?
I'm not sure whether that's the natural conclusion. However, she certainly can't testify, as she did, that there is no way to tell how accurate her assessment is and have that evidence be deemed sufficient to support the denial of the unconditional discharge petitioned by Mr. Snively.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Malcolm Ross, representing the state. I request that you affirm the civil commitment of Mr. Snively. I don't think that anybody wants to see a rule that says that the results of a statistical instrument determine whether someone is going to be indefinitely confined.
Well, did she testify that it was like flipping a coin if you don't use the actuarial instruments?
I believe she testified that pure clinical judgment is like flipping a coin, but she did not use pure clinical judgment. Even if she didn't use the actuarials, she didn't use pure clinical judgment.
What else did she rely on?
She relied on other research-derived risk factors, dynamic risk factors, protective factors, the results of the Hare psychopathy checklist revised, things that research has shown linked to recidivism. That quote is misused all the time. It refers to pure clinical judgment when an expert simply relies on their knowledge, education, training, and experience. That doesn't happen in these cases. They always have things that have been tied by research to recidivism. And I also think that the...
Does this court appropriately take into account an expert's level of confidence in the expert's opinion in deciding whether it satisfies the reasonable doubt standard?
Well, I think the only standard is, does she hold her opinions to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty?
And once she says yes to that question, our inquiry is over?
Well, I...
Assuming that the opinion itself supports the required findings.
I assume if she said she came to her opinion because of the color of his hair or the type of shoes that he wore, the court might be able to go further. I don't know, but that's certainly not the case here. She was qualified. There's no challenge to her qualifications. Her testimony is certainly relevant. Therefore, it's admissible. So then the question becomes a question of weight, and that's what Mr. Snively's challenge is to. It's to the weight of her opinion, and this court does not reweigh the evidence or redetermine credibility. And the evidence was her opinion. It wasn't the actuarial instruments. It was the opinion. She talks about the actuarial instruments and other information she relies upon. So under ER 703 and 705, the jury can determine how well based in the evidence her opinions are. And the jury apparently believed her and gave it great weight. I think there's the argument from Mr. Snively may be a misperception of what it means for an expert to rely on information. Rely here means to have considered it. She certainly is going to consider actuarial instruments. But even when you talk about these statistics that someone is, it's not a number you can attach to an individual. It's looking at a huge database of 8,000 sex offenders and saying of those people who had the same score as he did, 4 to 6% reoffended. You can't just transfer that number to Mr. Snively. That doesn't attach to him. What you have to do in every case, even when the percentages are that low, is say that 4 to 6 out of every 100 people reoffended. Is Mr. Snively more like the handful of people who reoffended, or like the majority who did not reoffend? That's why they go beyond the actuarial instruments.
Isn't that the nature of Dr. Phoenix's testimony, explaining why Mr. Snively is like the 4 to 6%?
It is. It is, in effect, yes. Because she said, for instance, that there are going to be very few, if any, people in that sample who suffer from pedophilia, sexual arousal to urine, and a fetish for diapers. Who are so good as Mr. Snively to offend over a 30-year period, hiding in plain sight in the community, who's never had sex with an adult, not once, whose release plan is to turn himself into a homosexual man, although he testified, it's just not working for me. He is wired to have sex with children, and that's all he's wired for. He can't change his sexuality. There was a wealth of evidence, which I've documented in the brief, besides her opinion, which she is presumed to have relied upon because she read all of that information. I won't belabor it here, but Mr. Snively is a pretty spectacular case of someone who is a ingrained, entrenched pedophile who is very, very devious. And the man had pictures of naked boys on his computer just a few years ago, and nobody seemed to place much significance on that except for Dr. Phoenix. He had a site visit to his brother's house. He told his brother to hide the medical marijuana that he was growing in the house. Nobody seemed to put much weight on that. Dr. Phoenix looked at a number of things that went to his credibility. And let me now shift, unless there's more questions, to the second issue, which is about evidence about the release environment. The statute says that the jury is determined whether he's likely to reoffend if not confined in a secure facility. And what our case law says about that is that it focuses the attention of the jury solely on what would happen if the respondent were living freely in the community. So the state's evidence about what would happen if he were living freely in the community is highly relevant. And at the end of the day, the ultimate answer to this question has already been issued in the West case, which is cited in our brief, 171 Washington 2nd at page 399. West says, to be sure, the state may offer evidence of the treatment and placement conditions that are necessary to mitigate the respondent's dangerousness, and the state may offer evidence that these components are lacking in the respondent's proposed arrangements for unconditional release. Now, although Mr. Snively focuses on this term homelessness and says the state tried to portray him as a stereotypical homeless sex offender, that term was never uttered. It doesn't appear in the record. Mr. Snively was in transitional housing. He was at the Secure Community Transition Facility on McNeil Island. He was supposed to be working on a release plan into the community. A sex offender in prison has to put forward a release plan that the Department of Corrections approves before they can be released. Here, Mr. Snively had a variety of changing plans, a variety of ideas about what he would do if he was released. His triggers for sexual reoffending were loneliness, stress, rejection, transition. All of those things are affected by his lack of planning. It was all highly relevant. It's been admitted before, and it was appropriately admitted here at trial. So unless there's any other questions, I thank the court and ask you to affirm the order.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes.
With respect to the mental abnormality question, certainly all three of the experts considered all of the facts that are relevant to Mr. Snively's history and then go to his makeup. The question remains is one of whether the quality of the evidence presented by the state meets the burden of proof to a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And as the Coffle case that I included as supplemental authority from the state of Missouri indicates, there is a difference between a psychologist holding an opinion and the state meeting its burden of proof. I think it's critically important to remember that this is a mental health statute. And turning to the question of the release
Why do you call evidence, it a mental health statute rather than a public safety statute?
Your Honor, all of the challenges to the constitutionality of this law and similar laws have survived judicial review, because the commitment that follows is linked to an underlying mental illness.
It's linked to a mental illness, but that mental illness needs to manifest itself in some way that is dangerous to someone, doesn't it?
Well, that would be the third prong. So you could
turn that a public safety prong. I mean, this is more than just mental illness.
Yes, it is certainly a statute that has public safety implications. There's no doubt about that. With respect to the evidence about what Mr. Snively's life would be like if unconditionally discharged, the statute limits that evidence of things that are said to play a role in his risk, in the risk of reoffending, be linked to the mental abnormality. There has to be a causal nexus between the identified mental abnormality and the future risk.
And the future risk is reoffense.
Correct. At the trial below, the state argued to the jury that they can disregard the expert's testimony altogether, and they argued to the jury
Didn't
that
they get an instruction that told them the same thing? You're not required to accept the testimony?
Yes, the standard jury instruction was there. And the state argued that Mr. Snively's housing plans were too loose or too fluid to be accepted by the jury. That was not proper, and the pretrial motion in limine to exclude that evidence should have been granted.
Duncan, didn't the court hold, I think, that who a person lives with upon release is relevant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why would this not be somewhat similar to that type of
evidence? Well, the difference has to do with who puts that evidence on, and while the state has criticized that argument as less than logical, the notion that this is something the state gets to impeach if the respondent puts it on. That is, in fact, what Post
holds. So it's relevant evidence, but only one side gets to put it forward?
Yes, Your Honor. And if the court reviews the concurrence by Justice Madsen in Post, she makes that point that appears to be illogical, but that view was.
Do you think a concurrence provides thin ice for a legal argument?
But if I may finish, Your Honor, that position was rejected by the majority opinion, the notion that there is a problem with this being a one-sided rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess.
All rise.